All right, welcome on to the Twitter NBA show post-game. This is also going to be tonight's Dunked On, kind of an abbreviated version here. We're just going to talk about this Cleveland-Toronto game, which is actually still ongoing as we speak. I'm going to turn it off.
It is technically ongoing, yeah. But it is not functionally ongoing. At the point we're recording, the Raptors are up 99-70. They have just absolutely thoroughly outclassed the Cavs. And what I've enjoyed so much about this is that it has been a team performance from the Raptors. They were getting contributions from all over, scoring surprisingly from Siakam had a couple nice scoring plays on the dribble drive, CJ Miles hitting shots from three, one of the best games.
Wright was outstanding.
Wright's defense.
Van Vliet might have been the best player in this game. Yeah, Poeltl was excellent. But yeah, the defense energy, and where I think I want to start with this game here, we can get into the nitty gritty with the box score and stuff, is, you know, all right, Kyle Lowry didn't play, Isaiah Thomas is kind of coming back, Serge Ibaka was suspended due to the altercation with James Johnson against Miami. But what can we take from this for a potential matchup of these teams in the playoffs if it occurs, and what's just kind of noise?
OG Anunoby did a very nice job on LeBron James. He couldn't prevent him from doing everything, but did a nice enough job, and especially when Serge Ibaka wasn't available as a help defender, to be able to do that and force him into some tough shots was impressive. And that's what you're looking for, are those one-on-one matchups, and I thought he did a good job. The Raptors have been searching for 4 years for a guy who can slow down LeBron James. Anunoby, it's one game, but I think he's done as good a job as anybody. I mean, James Johnson, that was a big part of why they acquired him. PJ Tucker, why they acquired him. Patrick Patterson back in the day, I think that was a part of the inspiration with him as well. I'm trying to remember with the timing with that. And OG did a nice job. Well, I'm not going to say he's going to do that in a 7-game series, but it's a data point, and it's a good data point.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously LeBron was very good still offensively in this game, the one calf who was. But, you know, just to have, I mean, and Zach Lowe was saying this the other day, and we've been saying it for a while, just to have a guy who, it's like, all right, if he tries to ISO or post up, it's not just like, like emergency help immediately, this guy has no chance but just to foul, you know. And pretty much everyone else that the Raptors have ever had, that's been the case, except for maybe PJ Tucker last year. But OG has the length and athleticism in addition to the strength, you know, with that 7'2 wingspan and pretty good leaping ability that Tucker did not. So just the, you know, LeBron's going to score, he's going to get out in transition, they're going to get switches, but just to at least have that base level of, all right, if you just throw it to LeBron and ISO, we're not just going to have to double team immediately, which has basically been what the Raptors have had to do, is really nice.
And something that has changed with PJ Tucker a little bit this year is that he was a reluctant three-point shooter last year, and I think Anunoby already is a little bit maybe more capable overall offensively than PJ Tucker is, and that's, I mean, he can be a lot better in a couple of years, it's just working in. And that was another takeaway from this game. I'm not sure how relevant this is in a potential playoff series between these two teams, but the overall capability of Toronto's support players, you know, like we saw Pascal Siakam take Kevin Love off the dribble. We saw him hit a couple of shots. We saw Jakob Poeltl play just a nice overall game. I thought he contested well defensively, was able to do some stuff on switches. Offensively, he battled on the glass, something we have seen before. So those guys are not necessarily going to be where the bread is buttered game in, game out in the playoffs, but a good performance from those guys can swing one or two in the seven. And, you know, if it goes seven against a good team, that can be enough.
Yeah, so I think that just the overall athleticism, intensity, the force with which Toronto played, these young guys were not scared. Dallin Wright did an awesome job on Isaiah Thomas. I think that's something that can translate to some degree as well. So all that's encouraging for Toronto.
Sure.
Now, am I going to pick them to beat Cleveland? No, I don't think so. And here's what I think will not translate. I mean, number one, Isaiah Thomas is 2-for-15 and -20 with three assists. Either one of two things is going to happen. Either he'll get better, and he looked extremely slow in this game. It did not look good at all. It was a problem. But either he's going to play better and be better, or he's just going to be, you know, not have nearly as large of a role as he's had. So that's number one. Number two, Cleveland 2-of-15 on three-pointers, and that's they're going to get up more three-pointers. I thought Toronto's defense was excellent to avoid giving up threes.
Well, but one thing I want to mention on that, Kevin Love, Kyle Korver, and Channing Frye combined for 1 3-point attempt in this game. J.R. Smith had 2.
Yeah, Love 0 3-point attempts. And, you know, I think they're going to do a lot more to try to space out Kevin Love, to take advantage of Valanciunas guarding him, a traditional center trying to guard him. So, you know, I think that's something that is not necessarily going to translate. What else you got?
One of the other things that made this game interesting interesting, I'm not really sure how it translates, was Cleveland turning to Tristan Thompson early when they were having a little bit of trouble against Toronto. It worked for a brief period of time, but then Toronto kind of got back into it. They were still getting beasted on the offensive glass a little bit. That was Poeltl's worst stretch, was when Tristan was on the floor. But there isn't really that much. There's kind of a ceiling to a point on those kind of lineups, just because they don't have as much spacing, there isn't as much versatility offensively, and you can execute to just focus on Tristan Thompson a little bit more. And it also helped that Cleveland just wasn't making their shots. I mean, that was another element of this.
No, I mean, at halftime, Cleveland was like 2 out of 25 on shots away from the rim. I mean,
right.
They've had some games like that.
And then the part of Cleveland's defense that you do want to be a little bit concerned with is the fact that they weren't taking anything away from the Raptors. The Raptors were getting what they wanted. They were getting drives to the basket. I believe they had 28 shots in the restricted area in the first half. They weren't getting to the line much, but that's because they weren't getting fouled. They were just getting to where they want to.
They weren't even close enough to foul them.
One mid-range jumper in the entire first half. DeRozan took a couple in the third quarter, and that will be better. The biggest difference with Cleveland as opposed to some other teams is not personnel, though there are some differences in this game specifically. It's that they'll actually care. And in this game, LeBron didn't start this game in show mode, but the rest of his team did, so he got there pretty quickly. And Cleveland is not as good as they need to be at stopping teams from getting what they want to, but they can be better than they were tonight.
A couple other things, actually, that I didn't include in my potentially will translate list. 44% offensive rebounds speak right now for Toronto.
And if they're not going to play Tristan regularly, that's going to be a weak point for them.
And then also, I think another thing is the fast break from Toronto. I think Cleveland has shown that they are not very good getting back in transition. So that's something that we can see. But remember, Toronto is going to have Serge Ibaka and Kyle Lowry as well. And, is Ibaka, DeRozan, Lowry. I mean, the reason I still think, and we said this during the broadcast, that Toronto is a massive underdog to me against Cleveland, no matter how well they play in the regular season. I don't think that Lowry and DeRozan are good enough to hang. With a healthy Isaiah Thomas, I think was probably better than both those guys in the playoffs last year. LeBron obviously is way, way better. I mean, those guys just have not been able to produce in the playoffs. And Toronto, maybe they've taken some positive strides. It looks like maybe, they're moving the ball a little bit more. They're empowering some of the other people. But, at the end of games, they go into ISO mode, and it's just, I'm not convinced.
You're questioning the assumption, but you're not moving off it yet, is kind of the way that it is. And you might not even, and so one of the, also in terms of Cleveland's transition defense in this game, which was generally abysmal, Toronto was able to get 19.2% of their possessions in transition, just 12% for Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
That's a concern. Some of it was just Cleveland also being a little bit more passive off their own defensive rebounds than I think they need to be. But, Cleveland is going to have to be better this year, obviously, to get through the Eastern Conference than they were, because they're going to face better opposition. Last year they had, we talked about it. Oh, I think we ended up talking about it more with the Warriors than with the Cavs, about how the Warriors had some good fortune, especially with Kawhi getting hurt in the middle of game one. But Cleveland, they didn't get any team's best shot last year to me. And so this year there are better teams, and there are teams more likely to get your better shot than the best shot than they did last year when they didn't. So I don't think that's going to lead necessarily to them losing a series, but if it gets six or so, then random chance comes in more, if it gets to that kind of a circumstance. So I think that there are reasons to be hopeful if you are a Raptors fan, if you are a Celtics fan, in a way that there were not before. But
And we haven't seen the Cleveland team in the playoffs without Kyrie either. Obviously has had some really good playoffs too.
LeBron has looked like LeBron so far this year. This has been one of the short list of his best seasons offensively, statistically. I'm not going to say that he's guaranteed to be as good as he was 2 years ago in the playoffs or anything like that. I expect it, but it's not a guarantee.
All right, let's take some questions here, and then we'll do a little bit of news at the end of this segment as well. It's going to be a little bit shorter than our usual dunk on here. What will make DeRozan top tier after his improvement in three-point and passing? Well, he obviously is much more aggressive. He had 1-3 today, which I thought, he had that 5-of-8 game against the Bulls. He had not been shooting it well up until very recently. Let's keep that in mind. And then also, he had this play where he came off of an Iverson cut and, you know, really nice footwork getting into a corner three. You know, if that's he banged another one when they went under on pick and roll. So that actually looked pretty good for him. So that's a reason to believe. But to answer the question, you know, number one, we haven't seen it in the playoffs. Number two, you know, he still is kind of slow. He's reliant very much on the mid-ranger. He's very much reliant on getting fouled as well. Some those calls sometimes are not going to be there. And just history. I mean, he hasn't gotten there yet in the playoffs. I won't believe until he does.
I'm happy you didn't mention the two things I was going to say. Well, one of them is in line with that. One is the idea of undeniability. The best players can get theirs at least to some degree against the best competition. We haven't seen that with DeRozan. And then the other big part is defense. DeRozan has been a bad defender throughout his career. Even this year, you know, there have been moments where he's tried a little bit. There were elements of this game where he just didn't get into the right spot. And the best wings in the league are at least passable on both ends. Now, point guards can be a little bit different, but point guards are orchestrating more of the offense, and DeRozan's usage is high this year and all that, but he's not that guy. He's not Steph Curry offensively. He's not transforming their team. And something that struck me in this game, the Raptors dropped 65 on the Cavs in that first half. DeRozan was 1-for-6 from the field. He was fine. It was, you know, wasn't terrible, but top tier, like, to me, that's a rarefied air that he can do, but he can be better than he was and be valuable. Someone said, are the Celtics going to make a move? My instinct is that the Celtics are going to use the disabled player exception. It's about $8.4 million that they got from Gordon Hayward being hurt, but I don't think they do much more than that, and they have a good rotation. Like, I don't think any other team is going to trade a superstar in season to them. I don't think, you know, as much as there is a possibility they could trade for AD in the future, it's not going to be this year. So I think they should be thrilled with where they are at this point this season. I mean, with Gordon Hayward being out, integrating Kyrie Irving. So you do what you can, but you don't mortgage anything in the future to get better now, because tomorrow's a better day.
What is the primary reason the Raptors defense has improved so much this year? And it starts with the usual reason, better defensive players.
Yeah.
Anobi has really given them something as well, right, playing more.
They only had Serge Ibaka for a third of last season.
Sure.
They played
Terrence Ross for a lot of the last season.
It's an interesting misnomer that gets out there, and this is a fundamental change with this year. I've written about this for the Sporting News. People assume that the trade deadline was the halfway point. It isn't. It used to be the two-thirds point. And so if you're looking at overall season-long numbers, Serge Ibaka wasn't out there very much. Serge Ibaka is a very good defensive player. So that's a big difference. OG has helped them. I think their second unit has been, like, their just defensive personnel in the second unit has been better this year. Yeah, I mean, I think Pirtle's looked better. Just Pascal Siakam, you know, all those kind of guys. And I think off the top of my head, they've been a little bit healthier. And so that helps. You know, like, they missed Lowry for, was it like a third of the season last year?
Yeah, pretty much right after Ibaka arrived. So this year, Toronto fourth in defense. And last year, as I recall, they're pretty much mid-pack. Let me see. Yeah, they were, where are they here?
Here, I can tell. Eighth. I already have it up.
They're eighth, yeah, but they're almost 2.5 points per 100 possessions better, and that's in a rising offensive environment as well. And so, yeah, I think they have better defensive players this year. You know, Pirtle has come into his own as well as a backup center. That's looked pretty good.
Off the top of my head, have their best players been playing a little bit fewer minutes this year?
I think so.
It feels like they have, and so when you play fewer minutes, you can push a little bit more, even though those guys haven't been key to their offensive development.
So Celtics should go after Lou Williams. That's an interesting thought. You know, I think, you know, he obviously has been really good. He had that 50-point game that we were both at last night.
We will talk about that in the 15 and 60, by the way.
Yeah, I do think that he takes a little bit away from what makes the Celtics great defensively. I mean, they really only play one guy who's not very good defensively, and that's Irving. They've got a lot of switchability, a lot of size. Lou Will totally takes that away. Now, they struggle to score without Irving on the floor, without Al Horford on the floor. I think that Lou would help that. I think he's playing as better than he ever has. I mean, his quickness, I mean, he was just blowing by guys these last few games that we've seen. But nonetheless, you know, I'm not sure that he really makes a ton of sense for the Celtics.
They also don't have Flotsam salary.
Yeah, it would be. But
well, they could use the DP. Well, how much does he make?
Yeah, he makes $7 million. So he would fit.
He would fit.
Yeah, he would actually fit. Yeah. So it's an interesting idea. I'm not sure that he's someone who's really, you really want playing a ton of minutes. You know, I mean, if you look at some of the teams they have to go against, right? They have to go against LeBron. So you put him in a small pick and roll, you're in trouble there. Yeah, they have to go against Toronto. DeMar DeRozan loves that play also. And Lou typically has not played as well in the playoffs either. So I think he can, you know, he definitely can help a team. But, you know, at the absolute best levels, I'm not sure really how much he's going to help you. But if the price is low enough, you might as well get him.
Yeah. Somebody asked if a Marc Gasol trade for the Raptors is realistic. I don't think it's kind of realistic from either perspective. The Grizzlies aren't looking to trade him right now. They should be, but I don't think they are. And then the Raptors, I don't think he makes them that much better. I mean, there is this outdated thing. We talk about it with respect for shooters, that reputation is outdated a lot of times. Marc Gasol's reputation as a defender is completely, for the people...
Oh, he's bad now.
He's bad now. Like, he's... And so that part of it, I don't think he makes them better.
I haven't seen him make a good defensive play, like, in any game that I've watched him all year, basically, at this point. Another question we had was, if you trade for a pending restricted free agent on draft night, do you have his restricted rights? You cannot trade for anybody who's going to be a free agent
anybody
after the trade deadline.
Anybody who could be a free agent. So, like, even if it's a team option that has not yet been decided.
Yes, that is correct. So you would have to basically opt in for sure, even if you have a player or a team option. Otherwise, right. you cannot be traded.
Yeah, and that's exactly why they do it that way. So yeah, it is there. So that's, and they structure it that way for that reason.
All right, let's take one more, and then we'll head into news here.
Do you want to do the Melo question?
No, I don't really have any of that. Let's see. What should the Nuggets do at the trade deadline? So what are their team needs? They still need a guy who can defend and hit shots on the wing. I mean,
they need to trade a big man. I would say another capable forward would be a really good thing for them, just to have another option. I mean, Wilson Chandler hasn't been great this year. Man, OG Anunoby.
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously, you know, they thought that they were going to be able to draft him at 24, and obviously they weren't. I mean, don't forget, I mean, we've almost forgotten, because he played the first, you know, month of the year, and then he's been out ever since. Is Paul Millsap. They're going to be getting him back at this point. And so, I mean, I think they especially if you're going to play Millsap, he's shot the three a little more this year, but, you know, I'm not sure he's a plus offensive player in their system, really, especially if they're throwing him these post-ups all the time.
I really hope that he's watching this, what they've been doing offensively, and saying, like, become a smaller cog in that machine and just dominate defensively, because there's a potential there for them to just be unbelievable.
Yeah, but then that means that really you need one more guy, you know, a Wilson Chandler type of three-man. Like, that's not quite good enough shooting. Will Barton is a guy, they've had some success in lineups with him at the three, but he's kind of more, you know, a guy likes to have the ball in his hands and a guy who can space out. And with Jamal Murray, Gary Harris will run some pick and rolls and go backdoor. I mean, and all that space that's there on those backdoor cuts is those guys work at the elbow, and you need a guy who can space out. And so, you know, I'll take a look here at who might be available. But I still think they need to get a little bit better defensively, but you don't want to do that at the expense of shooting.
And the other big complication with them, if we're being practical about this, is that they're not going to do anything to jeopardize going deeper into the tax concerns for next season.
Yeah, especially with Chandler opting in potentially.
Yeah, so like, you could say, oh, well, they'd be helped by getting somebody like Wesley Matthews. Sure, conceptually, maybe, but he makes a bunch more money, and so they're not going to add $6 million to their books for that kind of an upgrade in this season. So you could say it would help, but they're not going to do it. So
yeah, and I think, I mean, if you look, I have this list of players who I think, you know, might get moved or potential podcasts. So there's really nobody who's a good shooter at the wing positions who can play passable defense is going to be available. The reason that's the case, I mean, and especially not a guy who can guard threes, but, you know, sure. You think who's going to guard Kevin Durant on the team? Maybe, I guess it's Millsap to some degree, but yeah, so I don't know. And they don't even know how it's going to, I mean, Millsap won't even be back until after the All-Star break. So I wouldn't expect them to do anything for all those reasons that we discussed. All right, let's do a little bit of news here.
So I think the place that we have to start is the news from Shams Charania that Dion Waiters, it looks like he's going to elect to have season-ending ankle surgery. This was an issue that persisted from last season.
Yeah.
I'm sure the Heat knew about it. They were the team that had him before that. He elected not to have surgery, and he's been hampered by it throughout this season. Now he's going to miss the rest of the year. So that is one part of it. We can also talk about the other angle of this, which is that the Heat get a disabled player exception, just like the Gordon Hayward one, except that it's for a smaller value. It is for $5.5 million. And Miami, I believe they have 15 guys on roster right now, though one of of those is AJ Hammonds. But they're far enough below the luxury tax where it would cost ownership more money, Mickey Arison, but it would not put them into the tax at all. So they could theoretically use this or their room mid-level exception, which they still have.
Yeah, and for Waiters, I mean, the Heat. I mean, the Heat have been on fire lately in the win-loss column, but just a number of unsustainable close wins of late. They really struggle with ball handling. Josh Richardson has emerged to some degree, but he's very inconsistent. He can be very turnover prone. And so they might be a team, actually, you know, that could look to find someone else who can create, but they have a lot of small guys. I mean, what they really could use is a guy who could play the three and do something off the dribble, but that sort of player is, you know, a star generally, so not really available. But really, I mean, I think as it affects them this year, not that much, because Waiters just, you know, he wasn't playing well enough and he had this ankle injury. And so if he's going to keep playing that way, they're probably better off just not playing him. But the hope was that he could return and be similar to the player he was last year, and that now is lost. Well,
the counter that I would consider with them is to just throw some money at a straight one, just a point guard who can run, yeah, who can handle a little bit, maybe shoot a little bit. I mean, those guys are more available.
But what do you mean throw some money?
Like use the...
Just try to trade for someone?
Yeah, trade for somebody, or if a buyout
actually, they could be a Tyreke Evans destination.
They could be. And depending on how point guards see, I haven't thought about buyout point guards yet. I don't know if you have that on your list all sorted out yet, but
yeah,
they would be a reasonable destination.
Actually, you know who might be a reasonable guy to go there? Derrick Rose. If he were to accept a buyout with Cleveland, that would reduce their tax bill. Although, you know, Cleveland might not be too interested in helping out Miami, but...
They might be a playoff first round payoff opponent, but yeah. But would that be helping out Miami?
Yeah, it's possible, although Cleveland is playing so well. Miami is playing so well at this point.
Yeah, that's sort of an idea, or even just like just to have somebody else who can handle the ball. And the other risk for Miami with this injury, this is beating a dead horse for me, but I always have to talk about it because it's important, is it makes any other further injury a lot more impactful just because you have fewer options. They have a lot of guys on the wings. I mean, they're already missing Roddy Magruder.
Yeah.
But if Tyler Johnson misses time, he missed a game due to his shoulder. If Josh Richardson misses time, if Goran Dragic misses time, they just have fewer options there. So, and they're going to be battling to make it into the playoffs. So that they'll miss him in that way, but that is probably the biggest way I think that they will miss him at this point.
Yeah, and at least one good thing is that Justice Winslow could return as early as Sunday from the knee injury that's kept him out more than a month here. Where would you like to go next?
I think we should go to just a relatively forgotten piece of news, but Steve Clifford has been off the Charlotte Hornets bench for a long time, and he has been medically cleared, thankfully, to return to coaching. Strangely, we have never heard what his ailment is, but there is an ailment, and so he will be back, I think what I heard is next week, and so that's great. Steven Silas has been coaching in the interim status in his stead. I don't think that what has been, we both picked them as our most disappointing team of December. I don't think that was mostly a failure of coaching. I think Silas was mostly executing what Clifford would have done. He, you know, laid the framework and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's still good to see him back.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. Nikola Mirotic, rumors from both Salt Lake and then confirmed out of Chicago. Tony Jones, Casey Johnson, among others, Woj discussed it as well. He might have even been the first, probably was, that there could be the potential of a deal with Mirotic and Derek Favors as the principals.
That was the thing that really blew me away in this. So I Utah makes sense. They a guy who can space the floor. I think they are more closely embraced this, you know, four out consistently idea. But Derek Favors, I mean, he was a high draft pick. He's been a talent. There was 2 years ago we talked about the idea of could he be the best player on this team. He also isn't a perfect fit for the Bulls because they have a bunch of big guys that they paid, but maybe you can reroute him somewhere else, get something else. I just thought they would be looking to make it as a smaller deal. And if the way that I believe was Tony Jones had it was that at least the headline was that they're dangling Favors. And so that makes it seem like they're the ones who are initiating in that, and so that's significant. I mean, that means A, they're very interested in Mirotic, and also with Derek Favors, he's an unrestricted free agent. It didn't seem like he's particularly happy there.
Yeah, and so. He's the center. I mean, he's going to have to come off the bench as long as Rudy Gobert is there, and obviously Gobert, they made a massive contractual commitment to him. Pistons and Blazers also being discussed. I think that the construct of that would probably have to be something along the lines of draft pick compensation from the Pistons or Blazers.
Or a young player.
Well, and then just the bad salary that
And that's the big problem. Those of you who've been listening to our trade deadline previews, one thing that I've been talking about is there just aren't a lot of high-value expiring contracts around the league, and so the Bulls have to make a very different decision. They have to figure out where they're going to go with that. And it's a challenge because if the Bulls want to take on multi-year money, then they're gonna have to figure that out.
Another thing there, I mean, so John Luehr might be someone that we would talk about being involved there. Myers Leonard, maybe. And so then the question is, those guys, you know, Luehr has barely played this year. Leonard has barely played because he's not good this year. So you have to say, you know, you're taking on maybe $20 million in dead-ish money. Oof. You know, that's kind of like worth a first-round pick on its own. And then you get into Mirotić as well. You know, what is he worth? Presumably his team option will be exercised before he gets traded, or he would have to consent to the deal, which he likely would. And I think, you know, he certainly could help the Pistons. He could help the Blazers a lot with their lack of shooting. He could be exactly what they needed. But he's not as good as he's played this year, too. I mean, we should note that.
Well, I struggle a little bit with how he would fit with Portland in the sense that Al-Farouq Aminu, I mean, granted, Mo Harkless hasn't been as good as we hoped he would be this year. Just that overall, he would help their offense a lot. I think defensively, it would create some challenges for them. Where Portland, I think they've been able to work with a guy like that before, though they would probably play Tobias Harris less at the four, and he's had some advantages when that's been the play, though he hasn't played there all the time.
Brian Windhorst had a long piece about Isaiah Thomas. His own contract drama with the Cavs will assume that he plays a little bit better than 2 out of 15 going forward here, but that even if LeBron were to leave, it might make a little bit more sense for Thomas to re-sign there with bird rights, presumably on the thinking that if they can get him on a decent contract, then he could be tradable afterward, because no one else has a mechanism by which to pay him, but he could still be worth, you know, a decent salary.
Yeah, and the idea there would theoretically be that as sign him in that way, but also not overpay him, because then, you know, the idea of signing a guy to a value contract when they're in their 30s and small and a point guard can turn pretty quickly. And there is also the kind of the personal element. One thing I thought was interesting in Windhorst's piece was talking about how Dan Gilbert might identify with that, and the smaller guy, kind of that drafted Kay Felder and all that. And the problem with that is generally
Dan Gilbert has been rumored to have a bit of a Napoleon complex.
But the challenge is it would be an ownership decision, but if LeBron leaves, which I think is the more interesting premise of the would the Cavs sign Isaiah without him, LeBron, is they would be a very different team. And I don't think Isaiah would keep them afloat, and considering the protected picks and everything like that, they saw what happens when you lean into it and get good draft picks and all that. They were able to build back faster. If they just try to stay like the fringe playoff team for a couple years, that doesn't do them any favor.
Moving on here, we don't normally focus on the two-way contracts too much when it's just kind of a random thing, but Jalen Jones, who's, you know, about like a 6'7 combo forward guy, athletic, working on his three-point shot, he was waived by the Pels and then claimed by Dallas. It's the first waived player to ever be claimed. And Bobby Marks, using an interesting word, which I like, said the waiver claim process for a two-way is what has given agents agita, because I experience agita sometimes too while doing these games. But that the concern is, you know, like a Jamil Wilson, for example, if he gets claimed on the same two-way contract he was already on, then he's already used up his 45 days. He can't get paid anymore. He's just toiling in the D-League and just being kept around for next year, and he can't have a chance to actually get signed by another NBA team. And so that's why we saw, like, Ball and Boy, for example, some of these teams have actually signed guys to NBA contracts and then immediately waived them, so at least if they want to get claimed, they're on an NBA contract. So that's all really interesting, just as far as, like, you know, what it might mean for the market going forward. Jalen Jones, not someone who's, you know, particularly noteworthy in and of himself.
We on the trade market, we saw some reporting that the Hawks are looking for a high second round pick for either Ersan Ilyasova or Marco Bellinelli, and that is without taking significant long term money back. So I don't know if they're going to reach that. I believe Michael Scotto's piece mentioned the idea of what happened with PJ Tucker. I think this is a little bit of a different circumstance with those guys, but they can ask for it and they can see what they're going to do. But it makes sense as the Hawks to make a move with those guys because they're not providing long-term value and they can help out a team that's more competitive.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if it's both of those guys, but again, you've noted the problem of teams not necessarily having expiring contracts to send back. So now, all right, you're sending out Ilyasova, you're sending out Bellinelli. Yeah, those guys can help a little bit, but now are you also going to send some dead money for 2018-19 back to the Hawks? You know, we've seen that kind of a construct before with the Andrew Nicholson Boyan trade, where, you know, Boyan could help the Wizards in theory last year, and they also got off of Nicholson's salary. But that might be the more likely outcome for those guys getting traded than like, oh my god, second round pick, these guys are awesome. You know, they're kind of, you know, if you're a decent team in the playoffs, those guys are, you know, your eighth man, your ninth man, something like that.
Something that ended up coming up on the broadcast, because it affected the game that we did, both Serge Ibaka and James Johnson were not only ejected for throwing punches at each other, they were also each suspended for one game. James Johnson did that in their last game when they played the Indiana Pacers, and Serge Ibaka did it today in their win against Cavs.
Yeah, and Ibaka, you know, I was a little surprised that it wasn't more, because this is the second year in a row he's been ejected for throwing punches. Maybe as a repeat offender, he might have gotten more, but Johnson did in fact throw the first punch, and Ibaka was just some relatively benign shoving before that. In other ejection news, Rodney Hood was tossed. I imagine he's probably going to face a suspension for knocking a phone out of a fan's hand who was trying to video him as he got thrown off the court. I don't know what he said to Tony Brothers, but Tony Brothers was rather vehement that Hood was going to get thrown out.
And that's a real precedent thing also, the idea of players interacting with fans,
right?
That sort of that sounds like something Adam Silver is going to make a mark on. And while we're on the Silver note, he noted during his trip there in London for that game, the game that was earlier today when the Celtics came back and beat the Sixers, that the NBA will not air the choosing of teams for the All-Star game. This is the least surprising thing, even if it is disappointing.
Nor will they release the order.
Right.
Boring.
But also unsurprising.
Let's see what else we got here. Steph Curry didn't play last night in their desultory loss to the Clippers as Lou Williams put up 50 due to a mild tweak-ish of his ankle. Some thought that he could play against Milwaukee. He did not apparently go through practice today, but did some light work. If I had to guess, it's more likely he'll return against Toronto on Saturday. That'll be a really interesting game. We also have an interesting story that Draft Express had, where I should say ESPN, but John Gavone, some of the NBA prospects who were banned from college this year due to some of the scandals are not allowed to play in the G League, because the G League has this rule that if you were enrolled in college that year, you cannot play in the G League.
It's very frustrating, because we knew those guys aren't going to be draft eligible for this season anyway, because the draft already happened. And so giving them just an opportunity to play in the United States, get that coaching, if the G League teams are amenable, because again, this isn't like you'd force them on a team, they would be signing these guys. And so if they want this flexibility, the players and the teams, then give it to them. And also one other note with that is with the terminology of getting kicked out, is you have to be, as I understand it, the rule is that you have to be deemed ineligible by the NCAA, and because this investigation is ongoing,
permanently ineligible.
So that's what happened to PJ Harrison, where he was actually allowed to do that and played for the Texas Legends and then got drafted. But these guys are not. Melton for SC is another one of those examples. And Mitchell Robinson just left Western Kentucky. He didn't get kicked out or anything like that. So those guys aren't ineligible. And so that it's a problem that the league should resolve. Hopefully they will resolve it.
Couple of notes on that. Number one, this is not something that's collectively bargained. The Players Association does not govern the G League. It is not in the CBA. This is just the G League decided to make this rule. And the stated reason for it, no one would comment on the record, but off the record, the statement was made, or I shouldn't say off the record, but not for attribution, anonymously, the statement was made that the reason for the rule is that they don't want players just being like, oh yeah, you're not going to play me, coach? Well, fuck you. I'm going to go play in the G League, you know, and that just makes the G League look bad. It's like, you know, I've always felt like the NBA should try to compete a little bit harder against college, as opposed to like, you know, we're going to be partners with them. But nonetheless, let's say that you have that stated rule. Maybe I think the compromise solution would be that you say, all right, if you've played a game in college this year, now you can't do it. But to just say, oh, you were enrolled in college this year and you can't, and as long as you do it before the start of the season, then I think you should be okay to do it. Whereas, you know, for something like this, it really, you know, like these guys couldn't play at all this year in college, so let them go and do it.
I support an even looser rule, but that rule would be...
I agree. I'm saying like...
But that's a compromise. Yeah.
I agree. I think if you just go play there whatever you want, you don't give a shit about college basketball.
Let's do a little bit in terms of injury news. There, a couple of things that were just maybe under the radar for us. Frank Mason, we knew that he'd been out because he hasn't played since right around New Year's, but the estimate is with the plantar fascia issue that he's going to be out 4 to 6 weeks. He had been incurred encouraging as the backup point guard for the Kings as they went through everything else. And Sacramento, you know, they need all the help they can get. And more importantly, in some ways than all the help they can get, they need all the time evaluating their young guys because they're going to have to keep figuring this out.
Yeah, and George Hill is back now after missing time for the birth of his child. But and at least De'Aaron Fox is back now, so they'll give Fox a little bit more run. For the Spurs, Tony Parker has a sprained ankle. No idea the severity, but he not playing tonight against the Lakers. Danny Green continues to miss time. It sounds like it's going to be at least a medium-term absence for him as he has not been able to get healthy with this thing. And then Kawhi also with that tear. There's some talk he could return against the Lakers. A tear in his shoulder. We have no idea what that is. And then Rudy Gay is still out too. So someone asked in the comments earlier, why aren't you doing that game for the Tour NBA show? Well, there's a big part of your reason. And then New Orleans also with some issues of late.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. New Orleans injury issues involve Anthony Davis. I mean, he's such an essential part of their team. He sprained an ankle on an alley-oop and he missed the game, which they lost to the Memphis Grizzlies. We'll see if that ends up mattering long-term. And he is questionable for their game on Friday with the same issue.
Tony Allen suffering a setback on the Pels with that fractured fibula, out another 2 to 4 more weeks, but he had not been playing particularly much for them. Anyway, this is interesting. The LA Lakers, it had been reported they'd reached a deal for a 10-day contract with Jamil Wilson, the league now eligible after January 10th to sign guys to 10-day contracts, because now, you know, the only way you can sign someone longer than a 10-day contract is to sign them for the entire rest of the season, fully guaranteed, because the league-wide guarantee date is January 10th. So after a report on TMZ's service that a woman filed a lawsuit alleging she contracted an STD from Wilson while dating him, and that Wilson knew he had the STD and engaged in unprotected sex with her. So I guess that negative publicity was enough for the Lakers to say, we're not going to sign you. And, you know, there's some talk maybe that once whatever this furor is dies down about this, that he could be re-signed. But not great as a reason to not get signed. What else do we have?
Well, we can go to his fellow two-way guy in the Clippers, CJ Williams, who played last night, started against the Warriors, but left the game due to a sprained ankle. He is definitely not playing in the next game. Doc sounded pessimistic about it after the game yesterday.
Yeah, he said he'd be out a while. Yeah.
So I don't think we've heard a specific timeline on it yet other than that absence, but he's been helping them. And
oh yeah, and he hit the game winner like a couple nights ago
against the Hawks. Yeah. And the Clippers, that I don't know if that actually makes it easier or harder with the two-way stuff that they've been dealing with, because the deadline for that is pretty soon. I think it's January 15th. So I don't know how they're going to handle that. On other injury news, Mike Conley is, you know, he's trying to make his way back.
Well, I thought it was encouraging that he at least played 3-on-3. As this report indicated, because, you know, when I saw him maybe a week and a half ago in Golden State, he did not look like he was going anything close to full speed. So it does appear like in slowly ramping up his activity with that left Achilles, that's gone well enough that he felt like he could play 3-on-3. And so maybe he could make a return eventually, just in time to screw up their draft pick.
Miles Turner missed the game that they lost against the Miami Heat, and with a sore right elbow, he is expected to miss their next game. I haven't heard anything beyond that. And Sabonis, I thought, played pretty well in his stead, but it forced them to exhume Al Jefferson, which was not exactly great. And they just don't have that many other options. So again, everything cascades on it. And the Pacers, you know, they've looked a lot better overall since Victor Oladipo got back, but you need to win every game you can.
I'm just glad you used exhume, which is one of my favorite words. Two other small things. DeAndre Bembry has been out for a while with a groin injury. No sign of him returning anytime soon. Really a lost season for him. This is an opportunity for a team that needed some ball handling. He was really on the perfect team for kind of what he does, which is not shoot threes, but handle the ball a little bit and defend, but, you know, really has not been able to make an impact due to all the injuries he's had. And then Iman Shumpert had been progressing well in his return from arthroscopic knee surgery on his meniscus, now suffering some foot soreness, and he's going to be shut down for a little bit. Not sure whether it's serious or not, but Shumpert probably doesn't really fit into the Cavs rotation. Maybe they try to bring some energy with him, but they have so many other options there now.
He's a man without a country with Isaiah and Dwayne Wade and J.R. Smith there. Even if J.R. Smith has been disappointing, they're not going to throw Iman Shumpert in that spot. So he has that player option for next year that he's going to pick up. But again, he's not really a big part of the Cavs present, and probably is a part of their financial future more than their actual future.
So that'll do it for tonight's show. Thanks so much for watching. Thanks so much for listening. If you're listening to the Dunked On version of this, we'll be back special edition Twitter NBA show Monday, 8 Eastern, Warriors at Cavs. Cavs. Can't wait to do that one. Also, 15-60 on the Western Conference. We'll be back with that for Dunkdown listeners late on Sunday night. We'll talk to you all then.